Okay, Google, turn on the flashlight.
Turning on the flashlight.
Okay, Google, turn off the flashlight.
Turning off the flashlight.
Yeah.
I didn't know that was a thing.
Oh, yeah, right, okay.
Welcome to GCP Bytes, episode number 11 for Friday, the 28th of February, 2025. GCP Bytes is a podcast where we discuss Google Cloud and tech. And I'm your host, Stephen Bancroft. On today's show, Google is streaks ahead of the other hyperscalers. Is Google going to be evil now? What's the latest in quantum tech? Plus, how has AI changed our Pixel phones? For the better, I guess. But before we get to any of that, I'd like to introduce the co-host of the show, Dave Wall. How are you, Dave?
I'm great, mate.
Awesome, awesome. And our very own GDE, Ian Brown. How are you?
I'm fantabulous.
Fantabulous. What the heck is fantabulous?
Life goals, mate.
Yeah, life goals.
Excellent. What have you been up to in Fortnite? Anything interesting?
Well, I haven't, but I know Dave has. He's cloning Max now.
Oh, yeah, I keep buying toys. I think I've touched on this before. It's a peril of having this business. People are like, hey, can you make a mount for this thing? And I'm like, that looks pretty good. So I bought myself a new little B-Link mini PC. Ian quite rightly says, like, it looks a hell of a lot like the Mac Mini M4. Mm. It's exactly the same height.
Same height, same shape, same look.
Yeah, case. Got them squircles, you know. Yep. Power buttons on the front, though, it's revolutionary.
It's got that going for it, yeah.
Yeah, but it's an AMD machine, 32 gig of RAM, terabyte of storage on board. It's all upgradable. It's probably going to be an emulation machine for me once I'm finished sort of making mounts for it.
Yep. I'll stick a link in the show notes for those because they look pretty cool.
Yeah, they are actually, yeah.
But at $1,200 Australian for the latest gen, it's not a cheap little bit of kit.
No, I mean, I got one that was less than a grand delivered. And actually, I think I ordered it on Friday or Saturday and it turned up on Tuesday. So I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah. No, they're definitely a good looking little bit of kit. And especially given that you can upgrade the RAM and the storage in it.
Yeah, for sure.
Fantastic.
It's pretty cool how many of these sort of Chinese mini PCs. You got like B-Link's a big brand, Minis Forum. I make heaps of stuff for Minis Forum machines, but also GMK Tech is another one that's
never heard of it.
Yeah, it wouldn't normally sort of appear on my radar. People ask for mounts, and there's a lot of them that are, I guess, like a sort of Amazon. Brands mostly, but they're sort of doing their own stores as well. Over the last sort of couple of years of making mounts for them, you can sort of see as their product design improves and the cooling improves on them as well. Because a lot of them they shove a lot of compute into a pretty small space, so keeping them cool is an evolving complexity.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I was looking at the B-Link one that we were talking about before, and just trying to fathom how they cool that thing is, because like it's got vents underneath, so it's drawing out off the top of the desk that you're putting it on, and then exhausting it out the back. And I'm like, there's a main board in there, and there's RAM and all that sort of stuff. Like it's all just crammed in there. How do you get airflow through that? So they must have like holes in the circuit board there somewhere so that it lets air through it.
Yeah, for sure. And the other thing that I have to take into account when I'm making mounts is how do I, not obstruct the airflow? It's not just about like having one PC. People will be like, okay, well, I want to say get three of them in one or two RU, so they're right next to each other, and Now, this particular machine, yeah, pulls in from the bottom and exhausts out the back, but they've got plenty of other ones that, say, pull in from the left-hand side and exhaust out the right. So if you put three PCs next to each other,
the one on the very right-hand side is going to be super hot.
This human centipede thing going on. So then I have to build, like, baffles and things into my designs to redirect the airflow.
Yeah.
But,
actually, if you go to the V-Link website now, you'll see that they've got a really cool looking thing, the EX docking station.
Yeah, so I was just looking at that.
How cool is that? And it shows it with the RTX 4090 mounted next to it. Yeah, that looks cool.
Yeah, I think they actually made their reference design for the dock available for other manufacturers as well. I think they've started to make it a bit of a standard.
Right.
Yeah. Maybe we need to get some affiliate links. This is not sponsored by B-Link, by the way. I paid for that PC on my own.
And now this segue to our sponsor. Well, that's really cool. And I don't have a need for one of those, but if I did, I'd definitely be getting something like this.
Yeah.
I'm looking at one just as a desktop replacement for the Mac Mini that I've got in the corner.
Yeah. I mean, they're ideal for it. I mean, like, you can do some gaming on them, but even if your needs are purely as a workstation machine, then they got heaps of grunt.
Yeah, well, it would be my home computer, essentially. I can keep my work and my home separate.
Yep.
And then I'll just put the keyboard and mouse switcher on them both.
Yeah, that's right. And just flick the screen over in the keyboard and mouse. Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Well, as cool as that is, I've done a couple of things as well. My NAS has been filling up. I've got a 20 terabyte NAS, which I know is probably not much. I mean, you can get a 20 terabyte drive these days, but when I built it, it was a pretty big deal. And it's filling up mostly with movies. So I got a couple of strategies there to reduce the space consumption. One is I haven't quite set it up yet, but I'm looking at Tidar. So Tidar is a tool that'll scan over your movie collection and drop everything down to H.265. So most of my collection at the moment is H.264. There's probably some MPEG stuff in there as well. But H.265, you can get significantly higher compression rates and the image quality is the same or better than H.264. So Tidar will look at your Plex library and scan over your drive and basically convert everything and then re-import it back to Plex and does it all kind of automatically in the background. So that's kind of one strategy I'm looking at. The second is I'm trying to get a lot of my personal stuff off my NAS because I've got, oh my God, it's so janky. I've got stuff all over the place. So I've got obviously a local drive on my main desktop, which I try not to keep anything on, but if I'm working on a big media project, I'll have it on there, obviously, because you've got to have it local. Then I've got a home drive and a group drive, Samba mounted on my NAS. Then I also use C-File, which is like a homegrown, a roll your own Dropbox.
Yep.
And that's accessible externally as well. But that's grown and grown and grown. My wife uses that as well. And so all of that's consuming NAS space. And of course, all of that has to be backed up, right? So that's all backed up to a bucket. And so I've ended up, and then I've got a Google Drive as well. So I've got three locations I can put files, and it's just like, it's just getting out of hand with stuff. So I thought, well, they've got the new plans out now. They've got a 2 terabyte plan. And if you sign up for a month, sign up for a year, it's $149 for 2 terabytes for the year, right? So I did that. I bit the bullet on that. Which I thought, you know, that's all right. I could go and buy a couple of drives and expand the NAS, but how much is that going to cost me? It's going to cost me
much more than that.
Significantly more, right? And then I've got the headache of backing it up and all the rest of it. So that's been my tech adventure. I'm taking all those storage locations, pulling them all back into one single hopefully I can fit all my personal files under 2 terabytes. And if that syncs to my local computer here, that's great. I don't really need to back it up because it's in Google Cloud. It's in G Drive. And since I use DreeDrive Laughs, they've introduced a new feature where you can do selective syncing. You can pick what directory you want to use, which is what the big reason I use C-File. I don't want to sync my entire ISO library to my laptop, for instance. Right. But on my desktop, yeah, sure, I've got the space. Let's do that.
So you could have a directory that's, say, like a media work in progress directory. Yeah. And if you're working on something, you put all the files there, they'll sync down. Great.
And
I've got a
local
copy.
And that only syncs to the desktop. Yeah. My laptop, I only just keep my small files and, bits and pieces and just Google Drive stuff, right? Just G-Docs. So that bringing in that new feature is a bit of a game changer. So I've been able to reduce everything. I still don't even have a terabyte free available at the moment. I want to get it down to 2 terabytes and then I'll be happier with it. But I can get a bit more life out of that now. So I've still got a couple of spare drives for it. It's currently in a RAID 6. It's got 6 bays in it. It's in a RAID 6 configuration. So I could bump that down, RAID 5 with one hot spare. I could bump that down to a RAID 5 and give myself another 6 TB, but I don't want to muck with it. I'll just leave it like this. And if I can get everything up into the cloud this way, I think it'll be better for me.
Yeah, I mean, I really like using Google Drive and, actually having the Google Drive app on the PC and mounting it just as a G drive, it just works. That's how I do all my work stuff.
I've had a love-hate relationship with it over the years.
Oh, I have.
I've gone through phases, yeah.
I've got a little Rust client that runs on my Linux machines that sync my drive. And I sync both of my work drive and my personal drive down to separate directories. But I tend not to store, and you've got to be careful of storing videos in there for obvious reason. If they're let's say creatively downloaded videos, Google can.
Well, none of that goes in there. That's locally stored only. Yeah,
but for the most part, I mean, I store very little in Google Drive that I think is risky. Most of my stuff is backed up to a cloud storage bucket, and then from there, it's actually replicated to an S3 bucket.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah. And because
he's mitigating platform risk.
Well, I'm mitigating loss of keys. I'm mitigating all sorts of things. It's easier to get into an S3 bucket than it is a Google Cloud bucket if you lose the keys to it. But yeah, it's just one of those things that sort of I'm not trusting any one provider and I'm not trusting any one backup.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough. I came close to losing a NAS once and, never again. I'm not going to let that happen again. Yeah,
I have before, which is why I'm so paranoid about it because it was a NAS that the business was using to back up data and we had no backups and then we had a drive failure.
Yeah. No, I came home. I had one of those little cheap QNAP ones in the early days, and it was under the house in my little. I used to call it the data center. Was it the joke? We came home, and my wife said, "What's that beeping?" I'm like walking around, going, "What is that beeping?" And then I realized it was coming from under the floor, right where the NAS was, and I went under, and yeah, sure enough, one of the drives had failed on it, and it was a RAID 5, and I got to get everything off there. So I started copying everything off and it took ages to copy everything off. And sure as hell, overnight when it was copying off, a second drive failed. And I'd got everything off though. Fortunately, the copy had finished before it had failed during the evening and I got everything off. So
same batch of discs?
Never again. Yep. I think so. Yeah, I did have, I did buy 2 batches to build it. But it was the same one. Like I did two purchases of 2 discs, but it was the same one in the same batch. Yeah.
Yep. Faulty batch.
So, faulty batch here. Never again. But besides that, I did a big rewire in the studio here and set up the MOTU cards, like I mentioned last week, and everything's running really well. I showed you guys a picture of my little rack with some of my music gear in it. That was fun. And yeah, I've got some of my other synths and outboard gear going through that. And I've been having a constant problem with the audio interface that I had previously. And this new setup is silky smooth. No dropouts, no issues, nothing. It's just work. Just turn it on, it just works. So really happy with how that little project's come out. Before we get on with it. Yeah, just before we get on with the rest of the show, Microsoft dropping AI, dropping data centers. Yeah.
They're cancelling some data center leases. So the story goes that Microsoft avoided leases in the US totaling a couple of hundred megawatts of capacity, which that's a lot of capacity, like millions of watts.
Okay, more millions are better, I suppose.
Well, maybe. So it's roughly equivalent to two data centers, and I'm assuming what they say is roughly equivalent to two full data centers, to like complete data centers worth of stuff. So TD Cowen, which is an analyst firm, for want of a better term, posited in a second report on Monday that OpenAI is shifting workloads from Microsoft to Oracle as part of a relative new partnership. And that's mainly because Oracle is among the largest owners and operators of data centers in the world and is spending billions of dollars in its own capacity. So OpenAI is shifting to them in a new partnership, which is, I'm assuming, good for them. But Microsoft has come back and said, hey, look, we're still planning on spending $80 billion on infrastructure this year, so all is good, mate.
Yeah, I don't know. And Dave, you postulated this could be a bubble bursting.
Well, I mean, potentially, right? But, yeah, that might be a bit premature, right? If it's just like, well, we've got a different option for this, so some of our options, you know, we don't need to execute on. We're not in a gold rush sort of mentality. So,
yeah. The rush has passed, we think, right?
Yeah, potentially.
Yeah, I tell you, we've got to watch out for these Oracle guys. They're gonna be mentioned a few times in this episode, I'd imagine.
And they do some really cool. And I'm not going to drum up Oracle Cloud, but they do some really cool stuff. Like, all clouds have got their free tier, right?
Yeah.
Oracle Cloud's free tier is so much bigger than every other cloud's free tier. It's not funny.
Mm.
It's like you can run the equivalent of an E2 standard instance in Oracle Cloud forever and it won't cost you a cent. You can run their MySQL implementation forever and it won't cost you a cent. So their free tier is quite a lot bigger than everybody else's free tier.
Yeah, I've got a couple of websites. I wonder if I should get there. Yeah, set up a Plesk instance and run a few
few properties across.
Yeah,
that's it. Yeah. All right. Well, I might look into that. There's Terraform provider, so it should be pretty straightforward to do. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get on.
Welcome to Oracle Bytes.
No, Dave.
I mean, if Larry wants to sail a yacht over here for me.
Yeah. You'll prostitute your opinions out.
Yeah.
I've got a boat.
I don't know if B-Link has deep enough pockets, but Larry does.
Certainly does. All right, let's get on with the community news. Oh, boy. All right, community news. Let's get back to Google, hey? Google, we've got Google Next coming up. We'll just mention that at the top here. April 9 to April 11.
In Vegas.
Ian, I hear Ian, I hear it's $1,000 a ticket.
Yeah, $1,000 US
a ticket. Ian's on his way.
$1,000 US a ticket, which is which by the time you account for flights and accommodation over there, you're like at least 6.5K in the in hoc.
You're in.
But look, expenses, they've got a really good lineup. Their featured speakers list is huge. VPs and presidents and GMs and that from all over Google. It should be a really, really good event. I am really hoping that they do stream it online so that I can watch it at all hours of the day and night. But yeah, it's a. It looks like it's going to be a cracking event. Oh, sorry. The tickets have gone up now because it's February 27th when we're recording this.
So right.
tickets from December 5th to February 14th is $999 US. February 15th to March 17th is $1,499 US. And March 18th until sold out is $2,099.
Oh, jeez.
Yep.
Eye-watering.
Yeah. Stabbing the last-minute people.
Yeah. Got to get those early bird tickets.
Yeah.
Man, that's a big difference.
Oh, it's huge. Yeah. When it's more than double.
Yeah.
I'd understand sting someone 25 or 30% for leaving it to the last minute, but not 100, more than 100%.
More than 100, yeah.
Anyway, it is what it is. Look, it'll be a good event regardless. It's a Google Next event. They're always fantastic. Yep. The next one we've got on the list is Google I.O.
Yes.
Every year, the Google I.O., which is predominantly a sort of developer-centric event, happens. It's sort of like Next, but for the people who do the work.
And all sort of device-centric, right?
Yeah. Well, it's all developer stuff, so it's all it caters to all the different tech areas within Google, so Android or web or cloud or whatnot. It's all developer-centric.
Usually coincides with when they release the A models of the Pixel devices. So there should be the Pixel 9a should come out about then as well.
Yep. Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Exactly. So registrations are open for that May 20th and 21st. It's live streamed keynote sessions and everything else. And you can do the Google I.O. puzzle as well, which is really cool. They have used AI in order to make the puzzle a little bit harder, but it is still 100% doable. And if you are very conniving, you can actually search up the solution. There is a super smart bloke who always does the Google I.O. puzzle, and he posts his findings online.
Prism shift.
Yeah.
Guide, reflect, and split beams of light to illuminate beacons and help reveal the Google I.O. 2025 date.
Okay. Yep. I
have to give that a go. Yeah.
Yeah. It is hard. And then locally, we've got a heap of events on. So probably the biggest one is Google Cloud's Australia New Zealand Study Jam, which is a 30-day virtual program for pretty much anyone. So it's developers, engineers, you name it. It starts on March 1st, and it's basically going, like, you've got 30 days, you get credits, go and build something on Google Cloud in using Skills Boost. Go and teach yourself a new trick. And the local GDG chapters will be doing events on Study Jam as well. So there will be like local Study Jam events held throughout the month. But that's a really, really cool one. You can sign up online there and go and get your credits to Cloud Skills Boost and get cracking and build something cool. And then going around the chapters, Brisbane, their Cloud and Meetup, Cloud and AI Meetup is happening on the day that this podcast comes out. So it'll be Friday the 28th at 6 p.m. 315 Brunswick Street in the precinct. And it's they've got a couple of talks on here. It's the power of AI chaining and thriving in an AI era. So that should be a good event. They also do some raffles too, so they get a free JetBrains licenses to raffle off, and which is really cool. I use all the JetBrains tooling, and it is fantastic. So go and check them out if you're in Brizzy. Sydney, GDG Sydney's March meetup is on again. Mandel Group head office in George Street, March 5th, 4:30 to 7 p.m. I'm assuming it says GMT plus 10, but I'm assuming they mean normal time for Sydneyites. And again, a couple of talks, leveraging Google Gemini, querying databases with natural language, and building accurate and reliable AI systems by grounding your private data. So that, again, that one sounds like a really good one to go to if you're into AI stuff. And then last but not least, because I'm sure that the other chapters have got something coming up, I just haven't seen it yet on their meetup pages or their GDG community page, is a global event, but it's GDG AI for Science in Australia. It's Google's DeepMind's AI Stack for Science. So this is an event online March 5th, 8 till 9:30 in the morning. And there's a whole heap of Googlers and the likes and scientists that will be presenting at that. And that's the community in a nutshell.
Very good.
Bumper selection of community.
Oh, it's huge. March is always huge.
No matter where you are, there's something you can go and do.
Yeah, and right around the world, like I get the notifications from the GDE platform that Google uses, and there is huge things going on all around the world, so it doesn't matter where you are.
Yep. Everything revving up to get the year started again.
Yep.
It's good to see. Yep. All right. Well, that's it for community news. Let's get on with the news items. And as we've been doing recently, we'll start off with some people moves. And Ian, you stuck this one in here just now. Google Cloud Security exec Samuel Potty to depart.
Yeah, so this one was hot off the press as of yesterday afternoon. So Samuel Potty is the general manager of Google Cloud Security business for more than half a decade. So he's been there about 6 years and he's leaving in March. He posted on a LinkedIn post. He hasn't said where he's going next, but look, he's got some pretty good heritage. He came from Nutanix into Google Cloud, and he's been involved with major launches like Chronicle Security Ops, which is now Google Security Ops, as well as Gen AI powered security stuff. So all the best to him.
He would have had a big hand in all the security acquisitions that they've had, like Mandiant and Simplify.
Quite possibly.
Absolutely, yeah. He makes no mention of what he's moving on to do.
No.
But there's going to be a...
I'm sure there's a lot of doors open for him.
Absolutely, yeah. But there will be a vacancy there in Google, so interesting to see who they put in that spot.
He did sing Google's praise quite a bit, actually, and it's not something that you normally see. Like, you normally see, like, oh, Google's a great company to work for and all that. But he said after a very high bar at Nutanix, I have not expected to have another experience that would be so meaningful. More about my next steps in another post. So that tells me that, you know, Google has really challenged him and has been a super rewarding position.
Good for Sunil, and good luck with your future endeavors.
Yeah, 100%.
Good luck with what you do. All right, then. Moving on with a couple of finance stories. Google, growing, number one fastest growing major cloud vendor. SAP number two, and Oracle once again number three. Here they are.
Evil Corp gets its second mention.
Evil Corp,
darling of the podcast, so friend of the pod, Larry Ellison.
No. At least it's not the other oligarch. We won't mention his name.
No. Well, Google's grown 30%. In the last quarter.
They break it down a little table here. 12 billion. That's staggering.
And to borrow a phrase from a dude I knew, more billions are better.
That sounds like wise words.
Yeah. I figured you'd say that.
Yeah, and this is the fifth straight quarter that they are the number one growing.
Yep. Yep, 30% in the last quarter at $12 billion. SAP coming in at 27% at $4.9 billion. Oracle, 24% at $5.9 billion. I mean, they're relatively small numbers, but here's Microsoft, the behemoth. Only 21%, I guess because they're so large, 21%, that equates to $40.9 billion. It's still only 21%.
Only,
yeah, yeah. I mean, I'd like their only 21%. Yeah. And AWS, 19%, $28.8 billion. But this, so yeah, Dave, you said that this is their fifth quarter. I think it is that they posted record
growth.
Last quarter, like they're down a little bit from last quarter. Last quarter was 35%. So you can't imagine how fast they're going to have to be putting gear into data centers just to keep up with that pace, which is why we see the shortages we do in our day-to-day lives. Yeah, indeed, right?
It's a real thing that you have to actually deal with. Oh, actually, no, there's not infrastructure for what you want to run.
Yeah, yeah. So there's... so I actually came across it yesterday. So Enforce type instances are available in Australia now. They're available in Sydney in one zone, zone B. Right. So you can have even an N4 that, instance if it's in B.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even that's taken 6 months, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And M3 instances, you can get them, but you've got to get a reservation for it first.
Mm.
So we've had to... really push our account team at Google to say, hey, we need these M3s to put our databases on so that we can actually get a reservation for it. And same with persistent disk. So hyperdisk storage pools. We requested 100 terabytes of disk in the storage pool with 240,000 IOPS and I think 50,000 gigabits per second of throughput or gigabytes per second of throughput. And that took Google probably 2 months to provision for us.
Mm.
It's just, it's that hard to get.
They had to duck
down to Scorp Tech.
Buying discs off everyone they can. Could you imagine the Amazon order for that?
Dave, that's what you need to do. You need to get a contract making some mounts for Google.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think you're going to need a couple of hundred more printers.
Yeah, just a couple, yeah. And some bigger ones.
Yeah.
So, yeah, fastest growing, hey? And on the back of that as well, speaking of growth and expenditure, Salesforce has signed a $2.5 billion 7-year contract with Google Cloud. They've made the jump. Google customers will be able to procure Salesforce offerings via Google Cloud Marketplace, while Salesforce agent customers will have access to Google Gemini models.
Yeah,
there's a reciprocal agreement.
And I think that Agentforce stuff, which is that automation and AI piece, is a big thing that that Salesforce is pushing now. So yeah, being able to have it Gemini backed.
Yeah. Interesting that they've mentioned a couple of customers in the move. So customers set to begin moving their Salesforce application to Google Cloud include Wayfair and Accenture. They're two very, very big companies. Wayfair in the US has a pseudo sister company in Australia. And Accenture, we all know, is a huge consulting business.
Yeah. I can't help feeling there's some real momentum building here. Mm. Tide's almost starting to turn. I get a sense.
Yeah, I think we're finding more people are more comfortable with Google, that they're not just going to kill off cloud. And I think that was the big concern early on is Google's graveyard. It's like, yeah, this is a cool new thing, but, you know, Google has cool new things and we love it. And then they go, oh, yeah, we don't like it anymore. We're killing it.
And a bit of a like, oh, it's a toy for developers. Like, you know, devs like it because, you know, it's fun and they can hack around in there and they can do a few things. It's but easy, I can't put my enterprise infrastructure in there.
Yeah.
And, you know, as we've seen, the platform has matured significantly, right, given the fact that, you know, like, put aside, I know we like to talk about GCVE a fair bit, but we put aside like VMware Engine, but just, you know, like having all the Palo Alto integration inside the amount of enterprise infrastructure and paradigms that can sit within your projects.
Managed AD is another prime example. Google Cloud has a managed Active Directory offering now. I know I'm using it at work. It's a fantastic, fantastic.
I didn't realize they had that.
Yeah, so it's literally Microsoft AD that is backed by Cloud DNS. So yeah, it's sort of, from what I can gather, it is a proper AD system with Microsoft DNS and Active Directory domain services and site security and all that sort of stuff. But then the DNS is replicated to Cloud DNS so that it's, so you can peer to it from everywhere, all through your org.
Right.
So it's not an Azure AD replacement, because Azure is a bit different.
It's an on-prem AD implementation.
Yeah. Oh, very cool.
And then you can, if you wanted to, you can integrate Azure AD if you really want to cause yourself pain and suffering.
To read from the guide here, Managed Microsoft AD allows connecting your existing on-premises Active Directory infrastructure from Google Cloud through a forest level trust, facilitating secure access to your org's data.
Yep.
Yeah.
And well, one of the caveats of that too, and this is not meant to go on a tangent to Managed AD, but one of the caveats for Managed AD is it enforces the domain or the TLD rules. So you, if you have a .local domain or forest, no good for you.
Yeah, right.
Because that's not officially supported. Cloud DNS does not support it, and therefore Managed AD does not support it.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Mm-hmm. So you have to actually use a genuine domain that you own.
Domain. Yep.
Which, I mean, which is better for safety anyway, right? Like, just in case that one day they make a .local or a .corp, you know?
Yeah, well, that's right. So you were mentioning the Palo Alto stuff. That is, for the most part, baked into Cloud Firewall now. Yes. So Cloud Firewall gives you all of those really cool little policy objects that you can do, fully qualified domain names and all sorts of cool stuff. We're sort of starting to play with that now. But everything is maturing to a point where it is no longer just a developer's paradise.
But all that stuff is still in there.
Yeah.
Right. You can still have all that flexibility. You can, you know, you can build some pretty cool stuff in there. And but also documents. When you need to put on your production pants, you can do that too.
Your big boy pants. Yeah. Just going back to what we were saying before. I think we're pretty deep down the path of Google Cloud now. It's not like Google kind of can't just turn around and say, oh, we're going to turn off Google Cloud in 6 months, right? Like, there's just too much in there, right?
Too much in
But what I think what they will do, though, is within Google Cloud, they will continue to spin up new products and then sunset products, right, within Google Cloud. That's going to be a thing they're going to do.
Well, we've already seen that, like the IoT core.
IoT,
Yeah, that went away because it just didn't have the uptake that Google needed for it to be profitable. So they canned it.
Yep.
Much to my disgust at the time, because I was using it. But, you know, as were a lot of other people.
For your cattle?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. That's sort of fallen by the wayside now.
All right. Well, that's enough for finance, but let's just move on with a couple of Google features. We've got, speaking of investing, Google to invest US $75 billion in 2025 to expand AI and cloud capacity. Technology giants expects to increase its investment by $75 billion this year to expand artificial talent intelligence.
And to buy hard drives for Ian.
Yeah.
And to buy hard drives for Ian. Yeah.
Yeah. Hard drives for me and compute for me.
So, I mean, this dovetails into the growth conversation, right? Like 30% growth, another $75 billion is totally justified. They seem to be on the right track.
Yeah, that's right. You have a look at you think about what $75 billion equates to in a quarterly revenue report. So they're investing about, let's call it half of their their revenue for the quarter in infrastructure, which is a lot of money. Like that's not a huge return on investment, given that they've still got people and they've got cooling and like all the other ancillary costs involved in running data centers. So,
but the more capacity they have, the more capacity they can sell. And
that's right.
When you want to keep doing 30%, you know, quarter on quarter on quarter.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, it's self-fulfilling, yeah.
Yeah.
Although they said not all the state investment would necessarily go towards construction. It is expected that data center builds and server house schemes will represent a large portion of the allocated funds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last year, they only invested $50 million. AI capacity build out.
Right.
So this is a 50% greater increase.
Mm-hmm. Well, they got to keep staying in the game, right? This article also goes on to say other tech giants already announced similar spending goals. Amazon's believed to be planning $100 billion investment in AI for 2025. And Microsoft said it's in its January earnings and intends to spend $80 billion on AI data centers this year. Even with their pullback on spend, they're still spending a lot.
So what I take from that is Google is investing more money for the revenue it's creating than any other company out there. Because Microsoft they're generating $40 billion a quarter.
Yeah, yep.
And they're only investing $80 billion, whereas Google's generating sort of, I can't remember the exact number, it was like $30 billion or $20 billion or whatever it was, and they're investing $75 billion for the year.
Mm. But everyone wants to know how much Oracle's putting in, because we're an Oracle podcast.
We need to get some Oracle figures for next episode.
Yeah. I'm going to get an Oracle t-shirt.
Welcome to the Oracle Show, and I'm your host, Dave Wall.
Oh, I hate it so much. It sounds so bad.
Ian, make sure you wear your sun t-shirt next week,
all
right?
Yeah, I will. The ultimate kick in the face.
I'm going to go install Java 1.4.
Yeah.
1.4, that's way too modern. 1.0, thank you.
Yeah, and look, speaking of doing stuff, Google has dropped a pledge not to develop AI weapons. This came as a bit of a shock.
Did it really, though? So you've got to think about what the last, let's say, 6 months have brought about in the world. There's been certain changes of guard and certain pressures that have been put on companies. Google's essentially killed off its diversity programs, and now they've taken, just on the quiet, just taken this do no evil, don't develop things that cause harm out of their AI pledge.
Well, in 2015, do no evil was replaced with do the right thing. All right.
And as we were discussing before the podcast, do the right thing can mean all sorts of stuff. It can mean do the right thing by the investors. It can mean do the right thing according to the government.
Or it can be do the right thing by the redhead kingpin and the FBI crew. Right?
I have no idea what that is.
You don't know that song?
No, I don't.
All right, I'll have to put it in the background.
That needs some background music.
So that was replaced in 2015, but more recently, they added that Google's AI principles will now focus on three core tenets, including bold innovation, which aims to assist, empower, and inspire people in almost every field of human endeavor, and address humanity's biggest challenges, responsible development and deployment, and collaborative progress together, which focuses on empowering others to harness AI positively. So, I mean, apparently that now allows them to use AI in weapon development. I don't see
how. I would be very surprised if DARPA in the US is not already doing that. Because if they're not using AI to predict troop movements within BattleNet. So there is such a thing as BattleNet. It's a a tooling that the allies use to map where all their forces are on the ground, and
that's
where
the combined arms thing,
Yeah. Yep. And it also maps where the enemy forces are or where they've been located. So if they're not already using AI to predict where those movements are going, then something is seriously wrong.
So of course they are, right? And then that's like the whole premise behind like Palantir, right? Go Peter Thiel. So like that is things which are looking at possible scenarios at all points in time, and you know, whether or not it's military movements or like suspicious fishing vessels, and like these are things that are happening right now, and this is just
China
Google wanting a slice
off
of the
coast
pie.
Of Australia.
Yeah, perhaps the ADF needs that to predict Chinese live fire exercises. Yeah,
we've already got it. I mean, we're part of BattleNet, but yeah.
Wasn't very effective last week.
the Australian Defence Force knew about the Chinese being there. It's interesting they've diverted flights out of Sydney because of that.
Well, only because the airline found out about it, and then the message got back to ADF.
Yeah, well, CASA. There's one of the airlines actually reported the vessel first because they were miles offshore, and that alerted CASA, which alerted the ADF about it. But they're also diverting flights. As soon as you take off from Sydney, you'll either divert left or right from your takeoff path if you're going out over the water. So that you don't end up in a situation where you could be in line of a rocket.
Of course.
That would be bad.
Good
that
times. Bad. Good times, everyone.
I'm flying to Sydney next week and the week after.
So this story sort of rings of ED-209 stuff and RoboCop.
Put down the weapon. You have 20 seconds to comply.
AI have previously raised concerns about ethical implications of algorithmically enabling killing, including the potential for dehumanization when people on the receiving end of lethal force are reduced to data points and numbers on a screen. Don't we already have that? So UAVs are basically that, right?
Yeah. And look, to be very brutally honest, humans are already reduced to data points on a screen when it comes to selecting targets for fire control.
Yeah,
they're already just data points on a screen.
Think of like a gunship sitting like back, you know, on the horizon somewhere, and they just see a dot and they just engage, bang,
The Apache gunships, when they came out 20 or 30 years ago, whenever it was, they had a target identification system in them. So they can identify humans on the ground. They can identify different types of tanks and armored personnel carriers and different types of vehicles, and select what is the most effective engagement to neutralize a risk. And they can do that from below the horizon. So they've got got the dish above the rotors, and it picks out everything, puts it on a screen and goes, here's your top targets.
Yeah. So, I mean, what I'm getting grokking from that, Ian, is that what we're worried about AI doing, we're actually kind of doing already anyway.
Been doing it for decades.
Exactly, yeah.
AI is just going to be more efficient at it. So there was a comment here from Elke Schwartz, sorry if I butchered your name, who's a professor of political theory at Queen Mary University in London, has said, Google now feels comfortable enough to make such a substantial public change without having to face a significant backlash or repercussions, gives you a sense of where we are with ethical concerns about profiteering from violence, to put it somewhat crudely. It indicates a worrying acceptance of building out a war economy.
Well, we're heading down that path anyway, and I can't help feel that this change in tact has come about because China now has AI. There are potential rogue states have access to AI, and they're not going to have a do no evil charter.
Nope.
Right? They're going to do what they want with it, And, you know, it's, I guess it's in the US's interest, at least. I was going to say everyone's interest, but it's at least in the US's interest that they start to use this technology for their defense as well.
Yeah.
Kind of has to be.
I mean, more crudely, though, is that, like, the Defense Department was always going to be using this. There were people who want to play ball, and this is purely just Google being like, yeah, well, we want a slice of that pie as well.
Yeah.
Right? It's like,
yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I look at this as a, so China doesn't take on the US. In like, they don't have shows of force against the US because they know full well that the US doesn't tolerate it. So what are they doing? They're doing a show of force against Australia and New Zealand because they're off the coast of New Zealand as well.
That's right.
And so I think what's going to happen there is that will backfire on them because from what I read the other day, New Zealand is very seriously considering becoming a member of AUKUS, which is Australia, yeah. US and UK allegiance.
Right. So it'd be ANZACUS. Something like that.
It'll be something. But if that happens, then all of a sudden you've got a situation where, you know, China's starting to do shows of force against Australia and New Zealand. New Zealand sign up to AUKUS. Now they get all the intel that we get.
Yeah, yeah. And the nuclear subs when they're built.
Well, no. So New Zealand has a zero nuclear policy. They won't have nuclear subs in their water. They won't have nuclear ships in their water.
Well, okay, maybe that's going to change.
It might do, but they have a zero nuclear policy currently.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, we try not to get down in the weeds of political discussion, but it's a bit hard when we're talking about
political change.
Talking about AI and weaponry and the current, political climate in our part of the world. That's going to be interesting to see how that pans out. Let's just shift gears a little bit here. This topic we like to cover on the show occasionally is quantum computing. I haven't had an article on quantum computing for a little bit, but Microsoft, joke going around, they didn't fix Teams, but they invented a new state of matter.
Anything to, other than fix Teams. I'll work on this.
Hey, but Teams needs an update, though. Don't worry about that.
New state of matter. Microsoft Majorum 1 chip carves new path for quantum computing. So what they've done is created a new type of qubit called a topoconductor. And it effectively becomes a replacement of a semiconductor in a quantum system.
A superconductor,
and it can have superposition as well. And this can scale to millions of topoconductors. This is a path forward.
But how many have they put on a chip?
Eight.
Scale to 1 million. We've got eight.
Yeah. But I think, I mean, this was actually like a pretty big deal. This article is very detailed in what they had to do. Like from a scientific breakthrough perspective, they've done some good work.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt.
I think.
I
was having a look at the actual chip, like fits in the palm of your hand type of thing. And to think that we're in an age where we can have a quantum computer that fits, like a quantum CPU that fits in the palm of your hand, is mind-boggling because 10 years ago, quantum computers were a pipe dream.
Yeah, you had these very rare machines that had like two qubits.
They were monstrous, like an entire room, and had to have cryogenic cooling and all sorts of other stuff.
Well, this article doesn't go into what the cooling requirements are for this, and I don't see any pictures there of it either. Or is that picture at the top there? Is that the water block that sits on top of it? Is that
what it is? It could be a water block or a liquid some sort of liquid cooling block, because I can see in the photo that's at the like the hero banner at the top, there's what on the right-hand side of the actual chip looks like the cover that sits on it, and that looks like it might be the heat dissipation, because it's got pipe in and pipe out by the looks of it.
And you know what that looks like to me? That looks like a magnetic suspension.
Yeah, it could well
remove any vibrations that that might occur, because you know you can't have. It's got to be really cold and it's got to be really still. That's why they suspend these things from the ceiling, because any movements in there introduces errors.
Mm. But it's so cool that they've got it down to palm sized. Because I remember seeing Google's quantum computer a few years ago, and it was ginormous.
Oh yeah,
like
yeah.
Absolutely.
I mean,
monstrous.
You can get commercial ones, but it's a full rack. You know, with the one rack for the actual CPU and the cooling required for it, and then another one to run the refrigerant and the compressor and everything else that's got to keep it cool,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I love the quote in the middle of the article. It just gives you the answer. Where have we heard this one before?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's where they're saying like what their whole approach here was, that the only way that a useful quantum computer will be like, you know, created is that it'll need to have about 1 million qubits, right? Their whole aim was like, okay, we know we can make a qubit, we can make 8 qubits, right? But to get to 1 million, what do we need? And the approaches that we're currently taking won't get us there. So knowing that we need to get to that, what's our sort of scalable solution going to be? And that's what they've come up with, this solution. But the things they had to do with like spraying individual atoms, right? Like we're talking like atomically precise manufacturing to be able to build these... You know, consider control systems.
You've got to think of, so when you're looking at the superconductors that are on these things, like, okay, we've got 8 currently on this. In a standard 64-bit x86 architecture CPU, you've got like 9 billion transistors. So... I mean, there's...
Yeah, but go back to, you know, 80s technology. We had CPUs then, and they didn't have 9 billion.
No. Well, the original x86...
Right? And they're usable, right?
The original x86, the 8086 machine had like... It was sub 30,000 in it.
So you get to that point, and you've got a usable CPU, right?
Oh, 100% you do.
Right.
And the fact that's what I'm sort of getting at here is like, okay, we're not at 1 qubit anymore. We're at 8. That's an 8-time increase. Mm-hmm. If you do the 8-time increase again, you're at 64, and we just keep stepping like that. These guys are well on their way to creating a CPU that is actually usable.
Yeah, and this is why they're saying that it's like this is now years away. It's not decades, right?
Yeah, not
so
decades.
You know. Potentially by the end of this decade, by 2030, you know, if not by mid next decade, then like these will just be an actual usable thing that it's doing all sorts of work, some good, some bad.
Yeah.
Programming AI models, no doubt.
Yeah. Cracking all the public key infrastructure.
Yeah.
But they won't be breaking FIPS encryption. Google announces quantum-safe digital signatures in Cloud KMS.
How good was that segue?
So they've introduced a couple of new encryptions. You like my segue?
Yes. Yeah, I love that. Yeah. Love it.
FIPS 204 and FIPS 205 in KMS, and apparently they're quantum-safe.
And I love that it's got a list in this article, because we love lists. I love lists. They're great. So Google detailed steps the company is taking to make Google Cloud KMS quantum safe, which includes offering software and hardware support for standardized quantum safe algorithms, supporting migration paths for existing keys, protocols, and customer workloads to adopt PQC, which is post-quantum cryptography, quantum proofing Google's underlying core infrastructure, analyzing the security and performance of PQC algorithms and implementations, and contributing technical comments to PQC advocacy efforts in standard bodies and government organizations. Spelt incorrectly, because it's got a Z in it instead of an S.
Also to standardize, but we won't go there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so they're thinking about it, looking forward.
And I think the coolest part about this article that I picked out was not just that, okay, they're making Cloud KMS quantum safe, which is awesome in itself, but the better thing is the software implementations of these standards will be available to Cloud KMS clients as open source software and maintained as part of Google's authored open source cryptographic libraries, Boring Crypto and Tink. So they are making sure that this knowledge is out there in the public.
Between us, do we know what makes an algorithm crypto safe?
I do not have that level of advanced degree.
No.
Beyond my pay scale, I don't know.
Yeah, I have no idea. I would love to find out, because it sounds like a really interesting area of software engineering. But I have no idea what you could do to make a cryptography library quantum safe.
But I mean, I suppose the key thing is that, you know, the people who do know what they're doing, they've worked this out now years ago, and it's being implemented in systems now, because if there are going to be, you know, useful quantum machines available in the next, 5-10 years, then we need to have the infrastructure hardened prior to that date.
Yeah. Because I get the feeling it's going to happen. Like, when it happens, it'll be a floodgate thing.
Oh,
it'll
yeah.
be like AI. It'll just explode, and suddenly everyone will have plug-in quantum cards, or NVIDIA will release the latest RTX. It'll have a quantum add-on or something.
Yeah. Yep.
And bang, everyone's got it almost overnight.
Yeah. Or you're going to have ready for it. Like North Korean hackers cracking Bitcoin wallets, like the $1.5 billion heist they did last week.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's going to happen quickly when it does.
I'm just sort of perusing the cryptographic module validation program doc that they've got linked in the article. I just Googled a boring crypto. And they've got a NIST document in there, but I can't see any reference to PQC or quantum in the article. Interestingly,
FIPS 204 off 205.
Yeah, it's all about that, but there's no mention of quantum in there. Interestingly, their test environment, their cryptographic module operates under Ubuntu 18.04 and Debian 4.19.37.
Cool. Well, the source code's there if you want to go and have a look at it and you can figure it out. All right, let's do it. Let's get on with the AI Wars.
AI Wars.
And pretty quiet from the AI wars this week, but we did have a Google blog article talking about 6 updates for Gemini on Pixel
that
make it better than ever. And it's a list.
More lists are better.
So we're all rocking Pixel phones. We've all got the latest Gemini installed on there. I didn't know, but you can turn the flashlight on and off with it. And
slow to the knowledge of the flashlight.
Slow to the knowledge of the flashlight.
Yeah, literally our light bulb moment.
Yeah.
Literally a light bulb moment. So we've got a bit of a list here. New AI models make Gemini a smarter and faster assistant. So we just saw the upgrade to Gemini 2.0 recently. And, I've been using it a bit. What about you guys?
I mean, I've been liking more the plug-in side of things, that now Gemini can control home devices. And for me, it can also integrate with YouTube music and punch things across. So getting it to do playlists and stuff is helpful.
Yep. That's cool. It also has multimodal capabilities. Gave Gemini Live more to talk about, you know, upload videos and images, get to identify things.
Conversations.
I've used that a little bit.
Free-flowing conversations.
Free-flowing conversations, yeah, yeah. You've also got Gemini started researching and writing reports for you. Deep research. This is something I've got to go away and do. I've got to look up acoustic insulation. I know it's pretty boring, but my reno, that's what I've got to do. I might try give deep research to look that up for me, to figure out what's the best one to use. We also saw Gemini started answering more questions in more places.
Yep. Even when your phone is locked, which annoys a living daylights out of me when you accidentally say the keyword in a conversation completely unrelated to talking to said AI and it pipes up and starts talking to you.
Mm-hmm.
you don't even have to say, hey, it just listens for, and I use that word that starts with G, many times a day. And
cancel.
And it'll even respond to it when people say it on a phone call.
Or when somebody's trying to show you how he can turn his flashlight on his phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That happens too.
Well, it's good, you know, when your hands are full and you can't like flick the thing and just speak to it and turns the flashlight on.
Meanwhile, if my phone's in my pocket and turn the flashlight on, it's pointless.
You know, if you worked in Oracle Cloud, you wouldn't have to say the G word that often.
Well, I wouldn't have a phone then, would I?
No, but I'd also be a far less happy individual.
And number five on the list, this is your thing, Dave. Extensions gave Gemini all kinds of new uses.
Yeah, that's the one that I like, right? That's where I want the assistant to do things for me. And this is where, like, I'm very excited about the updates to the assistant itself on the screens being upgraded. You know, hopefully we end up with your new home hub devices at some point, Google, please.
I would like to see it turn on my smart TV because I've got a Google TV. So it'd be really cool if I could get it to turn that on.
Yeah.
I can turn
it on. It's one of the use cases that it's got. It's like dim your lights or turn on your TV. I'm like, fantastic, turn my TV on. I want to see it turn the TV on.
You haven't tried that yet?
Nope. No, I didn't even know you can do it.
Yeah, I can ask mine, say like, hey, I want to watch, I don't know, a certain TV show, say on Netflix, and tell it on which TV I want it to go, and it will do it.
Yeah, right.
It's not something I do often. Like I do music all the time and on which groups of speakers and stuff around the house, but I can do it for TVs too.
Okay. You know you can turn the flashlight on and off.
Oh, really? Oh, amazing. That's going to make $1 billion.
More exciting there, Baggy? You can actually set an alarm.
Oh, now that I have done before.
Yeah.
I'm a Luddite when it comes to automation, really. And finally, number six, a redesign and simpler interface made it easier to tell Gemini what you need. Well, there you go. Redesigned interface. So you had to include that in there.
Hey,
yeah.
Can I just come in with a jeers for a moment? A little assistant jeers. Right. Cheers to being able to set alarms, right? Great.
Yeah.
Jeers that I can't do recurring alarms. Like, I want to have the same alarm on my home hub screen, say like a 6:30 alarm Monday to Friday.
Yep.
Why can't I do that?
Why not?
I don't know.
Can't you just say set an alarm for 6:30 every weekday?
I'd have to create an extra automation to be able to do it. You can't just have an alarm and then set recurring.
Hey, Google, set an alarm for 6:30 every day.
But can you, no? But you're doing it on your phone,
yeah.
Right? I don't want it on my phone. I want it on my home hub.
Yeah, because can't you just do the same thing on the home hub?
No, well, I can't.
Okay. Interesting. Interesting. I'll have to give that a whirl.
Give that a go.
Give it a go.
When I go upstairs.
Yep.
And then I'll have to figure out how I can turn that alarm off because.
And then finally for the AI wars, Google Cloud launches first Blackwell AI GPU powered instances, 72-way GB200 with 72 B200 GPUs and 36 Grace CPUs.
That took you a bit. That was like...
I know. This article goes into it. Oh, boy, there's lots of numbers and figures and models and all sorts of stuff. A4X virtual machines, which are powered by NVIDIA's GB200-based NVL72 machines. These rack-scale systems feature 72 B200 GPUs and 36 Grace CPUs. These are whoppers.
Yeah. Exaflop per machine.
So the Grace CPU, so... Google's A4X VMs leverage NVIDIA's NVL72 machines, which have 72 B200 GPUs and 36 72-core Grace CPUs. They're ARMv9-based Neoverse V2 cores.
Nearly 2,600
36 72-core CPUs and 72 GPUs.
Yeah, and they're all interconnected with NVLink, which we saw before with the Grace Hopper rack system. Yeah,
So they feature Titanium ML network adapters built on NVIDIA's ConnectX 7 NICs, and that gives it a proposed 28.8 terabits per second, or 72 by 400 gigabit per second of GPU to GPU traffic. Which is an insane number.
It's insane. It's just getting outside of my ability to picture this. How many Olympic swimming pools is that? You know, you can't picture it. How many football fields?
it's trying to like fathom the size of our solar system.
Yeah.
Because I mean, okay, I'm not the space nerd that I once was, but I still, even today, can't fathom how big our solar system is, and
exactly how far Pluto is.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. It's and monstrous, or how big Jupiter is, or how big Saturn is, or whatever. But and then you're talking about on a computer, I can have 72 400 gig channels between the two GPUs.
Yeah, it's astonishing, especially how far NVIDIA's come. I mean, obviously. The compute and GPU side, but on the networking stack alone, like since the Mellanox acquisition, I mean, I even saw something, I think today, that NVIDIA and Cisco are starting to, like, Cisco's now going to be able to run, like, the Nexus operating system on NVIDIA chips. So NVIDIA is not going to be selling that solution, but, like, Cisco will be.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's just, it's astonishing the amount of piping that they can do.
Oh, it's phenomenal.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you look at the actual performance of the machine itself. There's a paragraph here. It says, performance-wise, the A4X VMs deliver four times the training efficiency of previous A3s that use the NVIDIA H100 GPUs, which we covered not that long ago as like, these are the best things in the world. They have got outstanding performance. And now we're sort of like, they're
terrible, lame. They're boring. Boy.
Yep.
E-waste.
Yeah. In particular, Google Cloud promises over one exaflop of computing power per GB200 system, potentially producing 1,440 FP8, INT8, FP6 petaflops performance.
Again, it's too much. It's too much.
Like,
too much.
It's too much.
And then to cap it off, AI teams can deploy A4X VMs via GKE, which supports clusters up to 65,000 nodes.
I want to know what the hourly running cost is of one of these systems.
Okay, let's have a look. Let's see what they say.
They're not available in the Melbourne zone.
Probably not. Probably not. Melbourne. It's a compute engine. We're going to go with accelerator optimized. A4 doesn't exist in there yet.
No, okay, not yet.
But the A3 high CPU eight is about $8,000. $64,500 US a month. 208 vCPUs, 1,872 gigabytes of RAM, and 8 GPUs.
Can it run Crysis?
Add your cut into it and you might get it down to 62,000.
You've got to go to those discounts. All right. Well, I don't think it'll be a machine I'll be getting my hands on anytime soon, but it certainly sounds like a lot of fun.
I think running it up for an hour would cost too much money.
Exactly, yeah.
I couldn't afford to boot it.
Yeah, exactly.
You get a credit on that.
It should boot pretty quick, though.
Well, look, that's about it for this week, I think. It's been a lot of fun, guys, talking about the latest Google Cloud tech and tech adventures with you. Don't forget, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music. Go to Apple Podcasts, write a review. That'll really help the show out. And while you're on YouTube, why don't you smash that like button and start the discussion there as well. You can contact the show, contact@gcpbytes.com.au. You can find us on the web, www.gcpbytes.com.au. And don't forget, today's sponsors are Hive Tech Solutions and Mantle Group.
And Oracle.
Oracle is not a sponsor.
If Larry wants to have a chat with us, then you've just got my contact details there. So
Dave can be the host of Oracle Bytes.
That's about it from us. Anything else? I don't think so.
No. That's well and truly
you've
enough.
Said
Oracle
enough.
Talk.
Get off air. See you later. Bye.
Bye. And the power button's on the front. Killer feature.
Not at all a bugbear of yours.
Hey, no, it's been a very profitable design decision from Apple. Like, that's worked out very well for me.
Yep. Keep doing what you're doing, Apple. Keep doing it.
Yep.
Yeah.